We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Welcome back, everybody, to Plain Politics, this collaboration between the Star Tribune editorial board and WCCO Radio. Chad Hartman here, along with Patricia Lopez and John Rash from the Star Tribune editorial board. Good to see both of you. Patricia, let me start with you. Let me get your reflections on the president and turning the cameras on when there was a very public bipartisan meeting. I think it was 13 Republicans, 10 Democrats, his Homeland Security director talking immigration. Two questions on this. What did you think of it? And why do you think the president left the cameras on?
Well, you know, he was obviously, I think he's been under a lot of pressure to prove that he is competent, that he, you know, is in command of all his faculties. And I think this was his attempt to prove it. I'm not sure how well that came off. There have been varying interpretations of how well he actually handled that meeting and those negotiations. And then when you go to the, you know, to the topic itself, describing a DACA compromise as a bill of love as strikes some people as, you know, kind of an odd way to put things, especially given where he's been. And for those who haven't kept track, you know, DACA is, of course, the deferred action on childhood arrivals, people who were brought to this country as youngsters by their parents, raised as Americans, but have no documentation.
What do you think, John? Same question to you. Why did he do it? And let's put it this way. Did it work?
I concur with Patricia that I think it was an attempt to show the country that the president was fully in charge and fully engaged, and it did not work on that level, particularly because he seemed to contradict himself on several occasions and had to be pulled aside very publicly by Kevin McCarthy, representative Republican from California, to say, well, actually, Senator Feinstein means this, and we don't want to have to come back here 2 years from now. So he had to be pulled back from his more compromising
position. Can I just jump
position?
In? Just to clear, you know, just clear. Dianne Feinstein at that point was saying, let's just have a clean vote on DACA. And the president said yes. And I think it was a race which Republican was going to jump in, right, John?
I mean, because he didn't seem to know what that terminology, a clean vote, meant.
That would be counter to everything he has said, including on the campaign trail, as one of his signature issues.
Indeed. And not only was it a response to Fire and Fury, the book that has caused just that by Michael Wolff, and trying to show that he's, you know, fully engaged in what's happening with the White House, he ran partly with the reflection that he was a deal maker, and that was what his entire business persona was all about, the art of the deal, and his ability to get people in a room together and to get to a deal. And it seemed that for a brief moment there that that was what he was trying to do, but again, pulled back by his own side because of what you just mentioned, Chad, of, you know, how essential this was to the Republican coalition here at this point. And so here we are a morning later that they were saved to some degree from the immediacy of the decision by a judicial ruling about the Dreamers or the DACA program here. But this is an ongoing issue and one that the Democrats clearly feel is not only very important to them, but that they have the public on their side with.
Patricia, we'll get to the court ruling in a moment, but I thought it was very interesting to look at a lot of conservatives, very outspoken, Ann Coulter, Tucker Carlson, others. They excoriated Donald Trump yesterday, saying, wait a second, where's the guy we saw build the wall? Where's the guy we saw saying no amnesty? So how does Donald Trump try to walk this line?
Well, I've been struck by, you know, occasionally he has these moments, you know, where he said on tape that, you know, I'm going to take heat for this. He acknowledged this. He said, that's okay. I love the heat.
Yeah. So this I'll take
is,
it all.
Exactly. This is Donald Trump zigging when everybody thinks he's supposed to zag. And I think for the people that are inclined to support him, that works for them. Because what was the primary thing they wanted? Not the wall. That was always, you know, that was part of his shtick, I think. You know, yes, it's a campaign promise, but what they really wanted out of Donald Trump was to shake things up, to go counter to the establishment, and to do the unexpected. And that is what he is doing again. So now House Republicans are back on their heels because they were trying to marshal support for an even stricter bill that would make no compromises with the Democrats and would actually step up deportations. So now they've got their president once again reaching out to the Democrats and telling, you know, Ann Coulter and all the rest of them, I'm going to do what I think I'm going I need to do.
Is he going to do that, though? I mean,
that's the big question.
Is he going to stay with it, John?
He could easily consider this. He could be so ticked off by that federal judge's decision to, you know, to block his stopping of the DACA program,
right,
that he could turn on a dime and say, well, you know, I wanted to do the right thing, but this judiciary is out of control. You know, he'll probably accuse them next of being part of the same deep state that he now thinks his own Justice Department.
Yeah. He's already pointed out, John, that it's the Ninth Circuit.
Right, that they always run to the Ninth Circuit.
Exactly.
Now, he hasn't yet walked back the, you know, the Bill of Love talk,
yeah,
but that could easily be coming, and that's because you never know what this president is going to do from one minute to the next, which, you know, as we have seen over the last exhausting year, is not a good thing.
You know, for both the president as well as Republican representatives and senators, one thing that they have to clearly consider is the polling on this is clearly on the side of the dreamers and of doing something that most people consider fair and just for these young people.
Even with Republicans.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yes.
This is not just Democrats.
Right.
And
it
as we all know,
party lines.
We live in an age of optics. And if
yes,
they go to the logical conclusion of, okay, they're going to end this program, you're going to have camera crews on the doorsteps of these families, of these young, striving people who are contributing so much to their communities,
yeah,
and to the country, being taken away and sent back to various countries around the world, and that's going to only exacerbate the polling inequality that this has for the Republicans. So one wonders whether the president, being more savvy than perhaps some of the Republicans sitting in the room with him yesterday, realized that they've got to come to some kind of compromise with this. He ran, you know, far ahead of his congressional colleagues there, but my sense is they will find some way to come to some kind of agreement on this issue, because it just seems that the country is clearly
he wants another win.
So
before you jump in more extensively, do you think, let's start John and Patricia. Mm-hmm. Do you think, John, you first, they will reach a compromise with DACA as a part of it before, I guess we don't know the deadline now because of what happened with the judge?
I do think that they will reach a compromise. I think that the congressional feeling is there, and I think that it will be wrapped around some element of border security, not the wall specifically,
yeah,
but an increase of investment in border security that all sides can agree, you know, can be spent in many different ways, but not the wall.
What do you think?
I'm less sure. I've seen them snatch defeat from the jaws of victory before. All the elements are there, and I think that a lot of this rests on a president who, and I hope I'm not overinterpreting here, seems to want another win, particularly on this issue. He has made some noises before about, you know, the wall doesn't have to be, you know, the entire length of the
mm-hmm.
border. He's looking for ways to save face on this issue. He needs something because he did campaign heavily on the idea of a physical wall separating the two countries.
And who's going to pay for that wall?
And we know Mexico's going to pay for that wall.
I was
right?
going to point at you guys.
See, so he put himself in a bit of a box there.
Oh yeah.
But he is also, I think, really driven to by the idea of again doing what Obama could not do, and that is reaching a consensus on on immigration reform that would actually change what he calls chain migration, what we always used to call family reunification before they decided that was too generous a term. So end chain migration, create more border security, which a lot of Democrats, by the way, can get behind. So they're okay with that. And then this question of DACA. And, you know, he's said before that he supports finding a way to keep dreamers here. So all the elements are in place. I'm not sure House Republicans are ready to go along with that, but that's what we'll need to watch for.
John, let's switch here to Steve Bannon. How the mighty have fallen. I'm not saying he might not come back, because people can come back in this administration 2 months later. But think about, he was the latest architect. you know, that he had laid the path for President Trump before President Trump stepped in, and after initially with Cruz, goes with Trump, joins the campaign, is given credit, is co-equal to Reince Priebus in the White House, and slowly but surely loses his power. The whispers that he was speaking to the press, then Fire and Fury comes out, and Bannon is all over it. The president starts calling him Sloppy Steve, speaks out to people, and Bannon is now out at Breitbart. This is stunning.
Yeah.
It's an extraordinary story on every level. It's certainly the fall, but I think that the rise is what will really grab historians as they look at this administration. If you look at the two previous administrations, Karl Rove with President George W. Bush and David Axelrod with President Obama, they were people deeply steeped in politics, policy, as well as running campaigns, stuck with their presidents, and didn't have this kind of a challenge. Steve Bannon is someone who had been involved in multiple different endeavors, you know, came to the campaign quite late and became arguably the most powerful person in the White House besides President Trump himself, with none of those kind of qualifications. And as you just mentioned, immediately broke the cardinal rule in Washington, which is to try to be more important than your boss. And when he ended up on the cover of Time magazine about a week into the administration, I thought the writing was on the wall then. But
but his cardinal sin was he went after the kids. So he started talking
treasonous
smack about Donald, you know, Trump Jr.
Ivanka.
And Ivanka is dumb as a brick. Yep. And like there was no hope.
So
for
do
him
you think if
that.
If he doesn't go after the kids, but he still is offering some pretty torturous commentary about the administration, does the president respond as vociferously?
You know, we'll never know, of course. But it seemed to me it was very noticeable that Trump's lengthy statement came out after the, you know, comments surfaced about Trump Jr. and Ivanka. And we know what a soft spot he has for them, you know, how close he is to them. They're probably the only people in the known world that he actually trusts to some degree. So there's that. For Steve Bannon, I think, you know, he was a one-man wrecking crew from the beginning and, you know, made Trump's presidency worse, I think, in every respect. That you could, by every measure you could imagine. He was a malevolent influence in that White House that I think, you know, even other White House staffers would acknowledge. Certainly he and Reince Priebus, never, you know, got off on on a solid footing. And, you know, but there's no denying how important he was. He did, for a brief time, actually have a seat on the National Security Council.
Yes.
So for Trump to now dismiss him as just, you know, some guy who
worked
for me.
He wasn't a part of it. Yeah, that's his go-to.
It's his go-to, but it's just not true. I mean, you know, he was given an extraordinary amount of power and influence, and now he has seen how quickly all of that can be taken away. Which, by the way, I think, you know, part of what's gotten lost in all of this is that I think Trump was sending a message to everybody else. This is the head on a pike, you know, outside the fortress that said, this is what happens to people who are disloyal to me. Laura Mercer, one of his biggest donors, one of Bannon's biggest donors and supporters of Breitbart, was the one who personally pulled the plug on him.
Probably after a phone call from the president, right?
So but she did it.
Yeah, she did it. Let me ask both of you this about Michael Wolff. The book has generated endless headlines, including attacks on his credibility. Not just this book.
Yeah.
But other books where his facts have not matched up. And there are people who are viewed as very credible who've said, I didn't say that, I wasn't there. They're demonstrably false names and positions. I don't think Wolf's held up that well in some of the interviews. I don't doubt a lot of the narrative of the chaos and the uncertainty. But what about the specifics, John and Patricia? Has it held up from what you've read?
When he is quoted as saying something, paraphrasing just a little bit here, if it rings true, it probably is.
Yeah.
Those
right.
are not the kind of journalism standards that the Star Tribune, the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, WCCO Radio, and others would ever allow. And so,
as a fact-based finding.
Absolutely. And so, indeed, I think that within Fire and Fury, that there is a tremendous amount of factual information. He claims that he has tapes of many of these conversations.
And
you haven't seen a lot of people who have directly challenged their quote. They've said that it was perhaps out of context from that perspective.
Right. That, to me, is more important.
And what he allowed was the president to call it a fake book, in similar to fake news, and to allow the president's base to say that they discount all of it because of these errors. So it's a significant error in its own right from Michael Wolff in terms of doing this. And I'll just quickly put it in the context of this Friday, a tremendous film that I've had an opportunity to screen. I'm sure most everyone listening will probably see The Post, about the Washington Post.
Yeah.
And the type of journalistic standards that they put in regarding the Pentagon Papers case and all the way to the Pulitzer Prize they won last year for reporting on the White House. And those are the kind of standards that journalists are expected to uphold. So indeed, this is disappointing.
So did he uphold those standards?
Oh, no, of course not. I mean, that's that, and everybody knew that is the kind of, and I hesitate to use the word journalist, but that is the kind of writer that he is. However, the White House has also been caught in its own set of lies on this. You know, they tried to deny that Wolf was ever given access. Seb Gorka, of all people, another person who got fired from the White House, came out, I think it was yesterday, and said, yes, he had access, and we were all told to cooperate with him.
He said, I was told I had to talk to him.
I was told I had to talk to him.
Yeah.
And so so we have this extraordinary spectacle. You know, the fact is no respectable, reputable journalist would have gotten the kind of access that Wolf did. He got it because of, you know, previous connections that he had with Rupert Murdoch. And, you know, for whatever reason, obviously the Trump White House had some level of confidence in him.
Even though the Murdoch book is not that flattering to Murdoch.
No, right? Which is really surprising.
Yeah.
And, you know, if the Trump people had done their homework a little bit, they might have not been so surprised by what Fire and Fury turned out to be like.
Probably not the Trump people, just the president, right?
And the fact that, you know, that many of the principles listed in that book have not come out and said, I never said that. That's all. Those are all lies. And it leaves it in this sort of murky netherworld.
Yeah,
you know,
it's a little vague.
Specifics may be kind of vague, but the overall narrative. But the White House, of course, as always, doesn't have much to fall back on because they can't resist telling their own set of lies.
No, I mean, that's where they lose out. Last thing, and I'll start with you first, John, is this ruling about gerrymandering. We've got two more cases coming up with the Supreme Court, including Wisconsin. But this is a pair of federal judges struck down a North Carolina congressional map on Tuesday, condemning it as unconstitutional because Republicans had drawn the map seeking a political advantage. The ruling was the first time a federal court had blocked a congressional map because of partisan gerrymandering. So that's at one level. Now the Supreme Court. How significant is this as we look ahead to voting and we look ahead to the further partisan divide we have in this country?
Very significant, particularly if the Supreme Court upholds this decision, and significant from the perspective of potentially having to have a much more fair process in how they draw electoral maps. But what the result has been an exacerbation of the polarization of our politics, because you increasingly get politicians elected from incredibly safe districts, which allows them to be more extreme on the right and the left and less willing to compromise because they fear a primary challenge more than they fear facing an opponent from the other party. When you have more fairly drawn districts and more competitive districts, you get more people who are in the middle, more willing to reach across the aisle, and you get the country moving forward.
Patricia, when you look at the percentage of congressional seats where they are decided by 10 points or less, it is stunningly low.
Yes.
You know, and so could this start a wave of major changes?
Well, one would hope so. It is long overdue. This situation has been allowed to get much more out of hand than it ever should have been, gone to the extremes that, you know, even after this decision came down, you had one Republican that was quoted as saying, and this is as blatant as it gets, I thought it would be better to, you know, elect Republicans than Democrats. Well, you know, then that's the end of really a two-party system. It's the end of democracy as we know it, because our whole system is, you know, centered around, you know, competing philosophies, parties, you know, that go after one another. If you tip the scale, that dramatically, then that doesn't exist anymore. I think people are really starting to push back. They've gotten smarter about this. They've come to understand what it, gerrymandering, voter suppression, the damage that all those things are taking on our republic and, you know, on our system of politics, and are resulting in the gridlock and the tribalization that we're seeing now. And the time has come to really push back against that. I'm hoping that the Supreme Court will not quash all of that.
Excellent information. Thanks as always, guys.
Thank you.
John Rash and Patricia Lopez from the Star Tribune. Chad Hartman here, WCCO Radio. Check out Playing Politics multiple ways, StarTribune.com and WCCO.com.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.